Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB 19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!
Okay, and last but certainly no means least, we have Erica Maidonovan, who has come all the way from New Zealand to talk to us today. She is a paediatric nurse who specialises in oncology and haematology, but wears lots of other hats. So she's also worked in urgent care and primary care, so has dealt with, I guess, both ends of the spectrum from that sense. She is also a journalist in her spare time, and sits on one of the nursing unions over in New Zealand. I also think she probably wins the prize for the person who's shown the most dedication to get to this conference, because she actually gave up her job to allow her to come here. So I think that in itself deserves a round of applause when she comes onto the stage. As a result, she's going to have a fabulous trip around Europe after the conference, and I guess answers on a postcard for where she should go and see. So Erica's going to talk to us today about, not in this lovely weather that we've got over here. Erica's going to talk to us today about the late effects of childhood cancer, and I think it's a perfect way to finish the session this afternoon. Thank you, Erica.
So I'm also going to tell you a story about a girl. She lived in a house with two parents that loved her. They had a cat, and they had a sheep. But unfortunately, she was diagnosed with cancer. But she had her treatment, and she made her way out, and we call that remission. But her primary school teachers said her handwriting was so bad she should go back to the baby class. And her university tutors told her that other people can pass the courses, and why can't she? And maybe she wasn't trying hard enough. She was voted most likely to succeed, but after her treatment, she's always felt different, like she can't trust her body, like it has a vendetta against her. As I said, I was a paediatric oncology nurse, and I quit my job. I don't really know what's happening right now, but this was just an amazing opportunity. Couldn't turn it down. And with this presentation, I'm absolutely not minimising the acute side effects of treatment. Obviously, really upsetting to families and patients, but obviously, as clinicians, we're really focused on the cure, and we don't often think about what comes later. What if we asked what important to you? And that's what I've done, interviewing young people who have had cancer about their late effects. So the cure rate, as we've been saying, is sort of round about over the 80% mark at the moment. And as we're seeing increasing amounts of survivors, we're also seeing increased amounts of late effects. And the problem is these might not crop up straight away. This could be years, this could be decades after your treatment. 2014 study showed that by age 50, more than half of survivors will have experienced a severe, life-threatening, disabling event, including death. Can I have a show of hands? I think it might be most of you, but how many of you are doctors or doctors in training? In a survey by Signorelli et al., 63% of doctors felt that they had a really good handle on the needs of young cancer survivors. But one did note, it's really not occurred to me that childhood cancer was a high-risk thing. And one other doctor said, I treat young cancer survivors just like I treat the old ones. And to me, that's part of the problem. As we know, children aren't tiny adults, and young cancer survivors aren't like the old ones, but just younger. I'm going to assume that if you're treating 80-year-old patients, they're not going to worry whether their fertility might be affected, like we have in our populations. The time for treating patients with the sort of dualism model is over. We need to be more respectful of them and their families. And I'd like to introduce you to a model that would be quite common over in New Zealand. It's called Te Whare Tapawha. It's loosely translated to four-sided house in Te Reo Māori, which is the language of the indigenous peoples of New Zealand. It incorporates a holistic worldview and recognises that mind, body, spirit and land are all really important to health. The model really speaks to me as it's about the universal forces that are within all of us. It was originally conceived as a way of assessing the Māori patients that we have through services, but I really think it echoes everyone. We want to be seen as whole people. We're not tick boxes. We're not DSM diagnoses. We can see the patient in a more holistic context with this. We're taking a peek behind the curtain of their life and assisting us with the care we can provide them and their whānau, family. As I mentioned, the model compares health to the four walls of a house, all being necessary for strength and each representing a certain dimension of health. So we've got taha tinana, which is physical well-being. We've got taha wairoa in the corner, which is spiritual well-being. We've got taha hinangaro, which is mental well-being, or emotional well-being, some texts will say, and taha whānau, which is social well-being of family. At the bottom of the model, sometimes it will be whenua, which is land as well. And some of you might be thinking this is similar to the World Health Organization definition of health. Well, it is along the same lines, but I think the addition of spirituality is an important part as well. So, whānau and family. We all know that illness will affect the family unit, and we can see this in studies of IBD, cystic fibrosis, epilepsy, diabetes, and cancer is no exception. We also know that the relationships formed in childhood, such as those with a primary caregiver, can also be affected by childhood illness. But actually, heartingly, there are some really interesting and quite warming studies that have been done on this as well. In a study of survivors, one of the quite interesting articles that I read, it was talking about that survivors rated their parents as no more overprotective and just as warm as control groups, which I had, that kind of surprised me. I thought they might think their parents had, you know, been a little bit overbearing or more, a bit more helicopter style. And actually in parents, the literature, there is some thinking that it's also brought the family together, that it's not necessarily a negative impact on the family unit. So as we can see post-traumatic growth in our patients, we may be seeing this in our family as well. There's also been studies matching siblings with the patients, and sadly, that it's a little bit beyond the scope of this, but the siblings will feel worse in terms of family relationships, and it's something that is sort of being worked on by charities like Canteen, and I imagine the Teenage Cancer Trust here probably will do some work around that as well. But I think as well, particularly for us in New Zealand, there's the issue of travelling for treatment. And if you're travelling so far, we have two cancer treatment centres in New Zealand. There's a degree of diasporia. You're away from your family, maybe for a really long period of time, away from your siblings. You might be stuck with one parent and the other parent's not there. So it's kind of reconciling those things as well in our late effects. The other thing about whānau, family, is the fact that it's not just the nuclear family, it's not just mum, dad, 2.5 children. But whānau is everybody that cares for you. And what if we all thought about our practice in this way? A little bit about mental health. Some of the studies are a mixed bag as well. There's quite a bit talking about rates of PTSD within survivors. But I was really heartened to see a study that came out of New Zealand by Yallop. And it was talking about that survivors actually experienced in their study more positive mental health. So it was talking about 6.1% of the population of survivors had depression, and it was 10.6% in the teens that didn't have cancer. So that was something that brought a little bit of warmth to my heart within this research. There are saying that predictors of mental distress later on, it's popped up throughout studies. It's things like older age diagnosis, CNS diagnosis, unemployment, level of education, your partnership or lack thereof, low household income. And it's asking about those things in terms of late effects that could be a screening tool with people that might be at risk of the more negative or poorer mental health. This is a little bit about education. So this is a late effect psychologist report, which can be done if there's treatment-related cognition issues. I went to see intrathecal chemotherapy being given as a student, and I asked the doctor what one of the side effects was, and their answer was that it knocks a few points of IQ off every time we give it. And we can be blasé about it, but for some people it's a really big problem. In a study of over 14,000 survivors, 35% experienced neurocognitive dysfunction. But like most things, there is a spectrum of effects, so depending on your diagnosis and your treatment as well. One of the more confronting studies I read was out of St. Jude's Hospital. It was matching 3,000 patients with community controls. The patients were diagnosed with cancer between 1961 and 2004. They found by age 50, a survivor typically experienced 17.1 chronic health conditions. The lead author of the study was interviewed by Contemporary Pediatrics, and he said that 30-year-old survivors typically experience chronic health conditions more commonly seen in a 60-year-old. However, the authors did mention that these cohort, they are a little bit older, so maybe we're seeing, you know, hopefully less late effects coming through. With these tables, I have to credit one of my former colleagues, Joe Truscott, the late effects CNS. And I don't expect people to memorise these tables, but it's knowing where to get information and it's having these things in mind if you're working in a service that's not oncology, if it's cardiology, respiratory, general practice, that these are the kind of things that you might be seeing from, you know, some of your patients. You know, if you look, there is a lot there that is more common to 60-year-olds. And there's also things like, we've talked a lot about fertility. And if you do manage to get pregnant, there's things like the risk of subclinical heart failure in the third trimester because of the circulatory load. Everything with these medications and radiotherapy is a trade-off. They giveth and they taketh away. That brings us to radiotherapy. Like chemotherapy, the side effects do depend on how many treatments you have and what we're treating. But some of the risks are, you know, growth hormone, cognitive risks, cardiac issues. This was just a list from one of my participants about, you know, the issues that they have. Spiritual. The concept of spirituality is something people have been pondering on since the beginning of time. But it's more than church going or a belief in a certain faith system. It encompasses more than that. It's the concept of homeland and belonging. And some of you might have immigrated at some point in your life. It's the feeling you might get on the streets of Dublin or where you grew up. Studies, most of them in adult cancer patients as well as chronic illness in general, shows that faith does impact on our health, you know, our physical health, our mental health. Being a spiritual person doesn't mean that people are anti-science. There's things in this world that you can't explain easily, but you can feel them, but you can't touch them. Why am I so interested in this topic? Well, for one, I was a pediatric oncology nurse, but also the story at the start, that was my story. And that's me, and that's me, and that's my mum, and that's Janet, one of my nurses. I was 2.5 when I was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and people often congratulate me or tell me that I'm brave. But I don't feel like I had much to do with my survival effort, and I would put that on my oncology team and my parents. I am that 30-year-old, feeling 60-year-old cancer survivor, but I try not to focus on it because the stories that we tell ourselves matter. I could tell myself that I was cursed or that I am a victim of a primitive system, but I find comfort in thinking matter-of-factly about my genes. With our cells consistently dividing, sometimes there's going to be a mistake, and that's just unfortunate. I'm pretty good at not, you know, making my health go downhill. I don't smoke. I don't really drink. But I'm not going to live in fear either. I've often been chided by people because I really enjoy drinking Diet Coke, and I've been told it's going to give me cancer. But my right to drink Diet Coke is one of the hills I'm going to die on. Not that those studies were, had a lot of proof with them. I'm also not a fan of the word victim because it sounds like you've been mugged in the street. Remember that cognitive assessment that we saw in the middle? That was mine. And that was when I had a fight with the university where I undertook my first bachelor's degree. And listeners, I fought and I won that assessment. I got my compassionate consideration and I proved a point. I'm pretty good at learning ways around my deficits, and I don't think I'm doing too badly because I'm speaking to you today in my third year of being a nurse. That brings me on to my data. My survey population were young adults from the age of 18 to early 30s. They were diagnosed as adults or teenagers. And when asked about their thoughts on their late effects, perhaps indicative of this age bracket, two of the responses actually started with, "It sucks." And it really can suck. The first quote up there is from a survivor in her 30s. And when she was diagnosed, her family weren't really told anything. They were given a folder and told it's better not to know. The only thing they knew was that it could cause some coordination problems, but she actually has a heart condition now. I don't think she's worked in several years. A couple of years ago, her cousin was diagnosed and she's seen a profound change in how her family were treated and how the portion of her family have been treated now. Family meetings, things like that, are also much more common. From the way people talked about their late effects, there was a degree of grief. People wondering what things might have been like had they not been diagnosed. They felt that things had been taken away from them. One actually disclosed in the survey that she had tried to commit suicide while she was on treatment, and that even 4 years later, she's still trying to take it day by day. There was also the theme of shame that came through the research. One participant opted for an online survey because due to her treatment, her voice is affected and she doesn't like talking on the phone. Things like that aren't in the late effects guidelines. We need to be listening to our patients and working out what's important to them. Another said she can only write 9 words a minute. There were talks about coordination problems. There was dropping things, people talking about how their coordination meant that they occasionally spilt things. There was lifestyle changes, like for a time having to give up driving or having to catch up to their peers in terms of what was cool or, you know, trying to be a young adult again. Memory and concentrations were also a big theme. The other thing that came through quite strongly was worries for the future. They were wondering maybe increasing memory loss was actually a neurological condition. They were being told that if they didn't exercise, their heart would weaken, or the fact they didn't want to consider children at their age, but not knowing if they could have anything. There was one that didn't quite fit the criteria for fertility preservation, so they were shelling out, I think it was about $15,000 to get that done, even though she doesn't want children at this point. There was anger at not knowing, not realising, not being told by their parents, feeling like everyone was talking to their parents and not to them. They felt like they were being told something different every time they went for follow-up. But on the flip side, there was also gratitude, both for the hospital system, for the doctors and nurses that looked after them, and for the fact that late effects are becoming more widely researched. Patients want to be listened to as well by their general practice team. For them to have an awareness of late effects, to feel like their concerns are being heard and not to be made to feel like they're wasting people's time or they're drug seekers. They also wanted more information in regards to teenage stuff like how friendships may change, can you have sex on chemo, and things like that. I didn't personally see any evidence of post-traumatic growth, but I feel it may be because people were wanting to be involved in the survey because they were wanting to talk about their negative experiences, in the hope that these things would change in the next few years. I can relate to a lot of what was going on in the survey data. This is not having things investigated because it was probably a cancer thing, or on the flip side, some doctors making it painfully obvious that they wanted to rule out cancer. To a point where at one point I when I was in my urgent care job, I almost collapsed at work because I was having a real bad back pain. And the doctor took me into his office and he was just like, "Erica, I just want to let you know, I don't think this is leukemia." I don't think it is either. I was off last week with back strain. So it's little things like that. It's kind of reading people and working out what's important to them. You know, some people are really concerned about fertility. Some people aren't. It's just working out what people are worried about and reading the room. Coming full circle in the words of one of my participants is believe patients. And if you only take one thing away from this presentation, it's, well, that I've told you a lot of things today. Every patient is an individual. I was talking to one of the doctors I used to work with in urgent care, and she said she didn't really know anything on the topic, except they get fatigued, don't they? But just like there's not one cure for cancer, there's no homogenous they. And if there's any of you that work in management at all, it's not only the things we do, it's the things we don't do. And it's the way sometimes we make people feel that's the problem. Bringing it back to Te Whare Tapawha or the four-sided house, it's, are we valuing people as people? Are we really listening to what's important to them? What are their values? When I talked about this presentation with my hospital's director of Māori and Pacifica Health, Hector Matthews, he talked with a passion about this, and it was really echoed in the first presentation as well. There's the need to have honest, courageous conversations about these issues, about the really hard topics. And it reminded me of, there's a Māori saying, he aha te mea, mea nui o te ao, he tangata, he tangata, he tangata. What is the most important thing in the world? It is people, it is people, it is people. Thank you.
Thank you, Erica. I think I would speak for everybody here to say that I think we all had a bit of goosebumps when you were telling us that story. It was really, really brave of you to share, and I think we all took quite a lot from it. There's been some discussion on Twitter. I'll just pass the mic over to Lottie.
There's two things. So one person is also a survivor of childhood cancer in the audience, and he says that listening to you has made him feel lucky that he survived the way he has. But a lot of what you've said resonated with him personally. And I think people are just amazed at the long-term problems and haven't really been that aware. It's certainly something I haven't thought of, and a lot of other people in the room don't seem to have acknowledged either.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from the room? Yeah, I'll just pass the mic so we can capture it.
Hi, so it's probably for all of you to answer, if that's okay. I work in children's ED, and generally I'm terrified of that conversation with a family for the first time and kind of saying, we think this might be cancer. And often when we do it, the kind of kid goes out of the room to go and play with a nurse, and the mum breaks down in tears, and sometimes they ask about fertility, sometimes, but they don't normally. Normally it's just like such a mind meld moment. And I've kind of always assumed that's the right thing to do, but kind of listening to you today and saying, like, should you be involving the child in that conversation? Like, are there kind of key things you should or shouldn't be saying? Any tips for kind of a aspiring junior in this kind of difficult minefield?
Do you want to start?
I can start from a kind of clinic, from a non-oncology clinical point of view. So I think it is really difficult in the emergency department. And so it really depends on how clear you think that diagnosis is. So about whether you broach it. And I think actually hearing Erica speak and speaking to lots of cancer survivors and parents, I think the impact our words have is huge. And I think sometimes, I've had phone calls down from A&E being upstairs in P's, and I've done an oncology job as well, where people have called me and said, I don't know whether to broach this or not. And actually sometimes that's the conversation that you do need to have, is asking your seniors, asking upstairs, what do we do with this patient? Is it a barn door? You know, even if you've got a blood count that looks like it's going to be leukemia, if you haven't had the blood film yet, there I have certainly said, look, why don't you just send them upstairs? And that means we can prepare to get the right people in the room and do it in the best way that we know how. And sometimes the emergency department is not the best place to have that conversation. But it really depends on age, how sure you know, there's lots of factors, but I would say be very wary, because it's always nice to come from potentially the team that may be looking after them. So often I would then call Sophie Will or somebody and say, look, this is probably going to be this. Can you come with me? Can we have a look at it? Can we discuss it? So the first conversation is really important for the rest of their journey. Would you agree, Dan?
So I would say that conversation shouldn't happen with the family until you've had a conversation with the oncology or hematology team. If you think you're dealing with a case of cancer or a new presentation of cancer, you should have that conversation with the oncology team first, and they will give you a steer about how certain or how committed you should be to that diagnosis and how you might want to do it. It's very difficult, and I don't think it's fair to send the family to an oncology outpatient department without telling them you're worried about cancer, because they're going to sit in my clinic. Most of my patients don't have any hair. They have a central line, a nasogastric tube, and there's posters all over the wall about the Teenage Cancer Trust and Click Sergeant Cancer Care. You know, so there's quite a lot of, I wouldn't say clues, because they're more obvious than that, but we are in the Sherlock Holmes session. So they need to be forewarned, for sure. Okay, and it does make a difference how certain you think that diagnosis is. And I think a better way to do it, usually, is to get the oncologist to come down to ED. Actually, a very small number of patients present through ED with cancer. It's really uncommon. The vast majority come from other secondary care clinics, or they come from their GP directly. Not that many people walk into ED and get diagnosed with a cancer. It doesn't happen very often. It's not going to be a big burden on your oncology service. And that's fine if you're in the tertiary hospital. It's not so easy if you're not in the tertiary hospital. And that's where that phone call in advance is really helpful. What's really important for you guys, as you know, recognise most of you are not going to be paediatric oncologists, is that you don't overcommit during that initial consultation. Okay, so I saw a patient yesterday who was phoned through on Friday evening to one of my colleagues, referred over a 7-week-old baby with a posterior mediastinal mass. You know, that's likely to be a neuroblastoma germ cell tumour if it's real. I got a referral letter. That referral letter said that we've explained to the parents that the patient's going to see you tomorrow, have an ultrasound, an MRI or a CT scan and a biopsy. Okay? I saw them in clinic at 10 o'clock on Monday morning. The x-rays hadn't arrived after the patient, so I got the x-rays up just as they came into the clinic room. That looks like a normal thymus. Okay? I then look at the report. Looks like a large thymus. And I spent all day Monday trying to calm that family down. I spent, 3 hours of my SPA session seeing them in clinic, arranging an ultrasound, reviewing the ultrasound with their radiologist, and telling the parents at the end of the day, your child's completely healthy, please go home. Yeah? So, two aspects of that. The clinical decision, this is a posterior mediastinal mass, fair enough. Someone had discussed it with a radiologist, that's what they'd said, they thought was likely, and they'd made the referral. I don't mind that bit. But the bit that the parents found really difficult was that they were coming over for an MRI and a biopsy. And why did I think that wasn't important anymore? Mm. Okay? So it's that expectation. I don't know how long you guys might think it takes to make a diagnosis and start treatment for a solid tumour patient. So if you've got leukemia, that'll happen within 48 hours, because someone looks down a microscope and makes a diagnosis. The rest of it's straightforward. They need a lumbar puncture and a bone marrow, and their treatment starts. How long do you think that takes for the patient with a solid malignancy? Sorry? Yeah, so but it doesn't happen in 24 hours, okay? And lots of patients get sent over to oncologists to say, okay, they told us you're going to see us today and we're going to start some treatment tomorrow. It doesn't happen. It takes 3 weeks, 2 weeks. You know, unless someone's dying in front of you, they don't get chemotherapy until they've had a biopsy, the histology's back, they've been staged, and the staging depends on the diagnosis. You can't plan all that until you know what you're actually looking for. There's a process that takes a few weeks, and that expectation building at the beginning is really difficult to unpick. Which is a very long way of saying, speak to the oncologist before you speak to the parents.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes as well, we'd get patients in the oncology ward before they had a formal diagnosis, and the way sometimes I used to do it as a nurse, there'd be some really curly questions, which I imagine you'd get even more of as doctors, would be, that's a really great question. There's a whiteboard in there. Write down that question and, you know, ask the team when they come around. Because, I mean, if you're going to fudge something, that could go terribly wrong. You're telling them something, you're getting their hopes up, or you're crashing everything, and they're not going to take everything in. They might get things backwards because they've just been hit by... maybe your child has cancer. It's all right not to know all the answers, I think. And, yes, you know, get the oncology team in, they'll have a lot more answers. But I guess validate that that's a concern for them, that they can find that out from someone else.
Brilliant. We've run over. So I'm going to bring the session to a close, but I'm sure that our speakers are going to be around if there's any other questions people want to ask afterwards. I think if you could all join me in saying thank you to our speakers, I think we've had a brilliant afternoon.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!